a standard multi-currency term loan agreement, including terms of loan transfer. We want to understand the nature of the standard core documentation that we would use in a euro loan deal, as well as the ability of the syndicate members to transfer their obligations and commitments under that. We can understand that in terms of a summary review that I've provided of the LMA, and in particular of its standard multi-currency and revolving term loan agreement. This basically provides for two key facilities. We have the term loan, which is for a fixed duration, and we have the revolver. The term loan is A and the revolver is B. We can understand that on the left-hand side. What I have made available is a structural outline of this with two pages on the front page, two pages on the back, so we can reduce a 100-page document, a 38-article, 12-schedule document to just one page. All I've then simply done is I've marked this up, black, blue and red, and then drawn lines to connect all the various sections. What we're trying to do is understand this as a living document, a dynamic document that can actually not just specify legal obligations, but actually govern the relationship of the parties during the term of the facility that is entered into. So we can understand this having regard to the basic earlier original structures that I have explained. We will have the core financial provisions, we have the core obligations, and we have the core default clauses. We just need to see how all of this works. So what we have is this. Article 1, we have key definitions and interpretations. So we're going to define the borrower as the original obligor, finance parties. Finance party will include the agent, the arranger or a lender, the reference banks, and then any other separate security trustee. Will also define the lenders, the loan and the information memorandum. There's a number of other key provisions. Important clauses include, for example, the availability, that's the commitment period. The available facility is the amount that each bank is required as a proportion of the total facility to make available. We'll have a base currency. We have break costs, which are additional costs if there's repayment during an interest period. Essentially, what might happen is, for example, we have a 3-month interest period. If the borrower repays early during that period, the bank wants to ensure that any additional break costs are covered. The bank is required to place the funds which are repaid back into the market so it can generate further funds. But the difference between what the bank can earn and the margin that it should otherwise have received are the break costs. Those will have to be paid by the borrower. In terms of the facilities themselves, we then have the A facility, the term, and the B facility, the revolving. You can draw down under the B and repay and draw down again. If you repay under the A, you cannot draw that down again. With the finance parties, this is absolutely key in Article 2.2. The obligations are several, the rights are separate and independent, and then thirdly in C, the document provides for separate enforcement. What we're specifying is this: although there's a single loan agreement, single loan document, these are legally separate and independent commitments, and each of those will be evidenced and created by the separate drawdowns, and the drawdowns are provided for in the following clause 4 in conditions precedent. We also have a separate purpose clause. In practice, under euro-dollar deals, there'll be no purpose. The purpose clause is relevant if, for example, this is used in relation to a project finance deal, whereby we want to ensure that the funds are only used to support the particular project, for example, constructing a school or a hospital or a desalination plant or a nuclear power station. The drawdown is then provided for under Article 4, that's the conditions of utilisation. We have the initial conditions precedent, we incorporate these here, those have to be satisfied. And I've summarised the conditions precedent, taking that from Schedule 2, constitutional documents, board resolutions, specimen signatures, guarantor resolutions. We can add further conditions precedent, we can have other optional currency precedent, and then there might be a maximum number of loans. So we've already explained that we can have a very significant number of specific particular loans drawn down under the facility, under both the A's and the B's. But what can happen is this. Technically, that could be up to, for example, around 24,600 separate loans under the loan agreement. Because the banks may not want to manage all of this and they don't want to transfer that obligation to the agent bank, very often we will have a limit clause. So we can still have a limit on loans that will be set out in 4.4. So the separate facilities is provided for under 2.2, but we can have a total limit on 4.4. But what we'll also see is this. We can consolidate and divide loans, and that's provided for under 10.4. So we need to consider the relationship between these clauses as well. While there may be an almost unlimited number of loans, there may be a specified limit, but then again, we can also consolidate outstanding provisions and we can divide outstanding provisions if we want to balance our obligations at any particular time. The utilisation, there's a procedure for notifying this to the bank. That's provided for under 5.1. That's delivery of the utilisation request. We have currencies, a base currency, and then optional currencies. We select the currency and the interest period in the utilisation request. So we've got optional currencies in 6, and then we'll deal with interest in 9. We can have repayment and prepayment. We have repayment of the A, repayment of the B, with no further drawdown. We can also have borrower's repayment and prepayment. The banks want repayment because they don't want counterparty default or credit risk arising. But what they don't particularly like in practice is prepayment. And that then takes us back to the break cost. If the customers, borrowers prepay, they're legitimately entitled to do that, although there may be an additional break cost charge that's imposed. Interest, we calculate interest under 9.1. In practice, what will happen is the borrower is going to pay the interest, which will be calculated on the basis of the local IBOR rate. So that's in 9.1b. That was the London IBOR. Now it's just a general IBOR. So it might be Shanghai, Tokyo, Euro, New York, any local reference rate. But what the borrowers will also pay is the bank's margin. The bank's margin is the profit. So if, for example, the bank's making 100 basis points, one point of interest, 1%, which is 100 basis points, it will pay the LIBOR, let's say LIBOR today is 100, so it will then pay an extra 100 margin on top of that. If it's higher risk, the margin may be 2.5, 3, so it might be 200, 300 basis points. What will also happen is the borrowers also pay the mandatory cost. The mandatory cost is distinct from the break cost. Mandatory cost is a fixed charge that the banks have to pay for any outstanding commitments to the local, usually central bank or monetary authority, or possible regulatory authority. It used to be this was only paid to the Bank of England. Now it's paid to the Bank of England and the Financial Conduct Authority and the Prudential Regulation Authority. There's three charges, but these are very small. These are calculated on the basis of the bank's total outstanding lendings, which will obviously include this new facility. So we take a very small proportion of that total amount that's going to be paid. It of itself is very small. It might only be 20,000-30,000, maybe 100,000 for the whole year. It's basically a charge that goes to the authorities to allow them to basically assume their own administrative costs and ongoing expenses. It's a very small amount, although the borrowers have to pay it, because the borrowers have to pay everything that's required and will cause a cost to the lenders. We've then got the interest period. We can select the interest periods, and then there will be a default clause. And then we have changes to interest where the interest rate is not available on the local IBOR. We normally refer to it as the screen rate. We will have alternative provisions, and then if there is no alternative available, we will negotiate to ensure that alternative interest rate is calculated and available. What we can then do is this. Because we're going to present this and lay this out on a two-page format with two pages on the front page and two pages on the back, we can now begin to draw lines. And we can extend the lines from section 9 Article 9.1, A, B and C are the core costs that the borrowers will pay. But what we can then do is we can draw those over into a number of the other charges that the borrowers will also have to cover. So there will be the fees. We have the commitment fee, we have the arrangement fee and the agency fee. Agency fee is paid on an hourly basis to the agent bank for the time consumed administering the facility. The arrangement fee is paid to the arranging bank or lead bank. It's a proportion of the facility. It will be the highest amount. In practice, the lead bank that's going to set the facility up will take a small interest charge on the total amount available, possibly 1%, 1.25, 1.5, 1.7, maybe even 2%. That's its fee for setting the facility up. The commitment fees are paid to each of the banks in proportion to the amounts that they make available under the facility, and that will be set out in Schedule 1. We'll have the list of the banks and then the proportion that each bank makes available. It doesn't always have to be equal. If there's 10 banks, it doesn't have to be 10% each. They can be in different proportions. The commitment fee is a small fee that's paid for making the funds available. What will then happen is when those funds are drawn down, you'll pay interest. So the commitment fee effectively converts into an interest payment. However, the borrower is also going to pay a number of other things. So we've got tax, gross up and indemnities. We normally make payments in the Eurodollar market free from withholding tax. A withholding tax is a local tax that's imposed on the banks. That means they have to deduct tax and pay it to the local Inland Revenue Service. The banks don't want that to be paid. They don't want to lose funds because that's deducted off the amount that they would receive under Article 9.1. So what we do is we gross up. We have to gross the amount payable by a larger amount so that when we remove the withholding tax, the bank receives the expected amount that was originally agreed. If, for example, the amount is 100, let's say £100,000 or dollars, if there's a 10% withholding, to gross that up, we don't gross it up from 100 to 110, because if you gross to 100 to 110 and you take 10% off 110, that's 11. 11 from 110 is 99. So the banks would only receive 99,000. You gross up 100 to 111 so that when you take 10% of 111, you deduct 11, the bank receives 100, which is the amount originally agreed. There's also other possible tax charges, stamp taxes, value-added taxes. We then may have other increased cost claims, and then exceptions, and then other possible indemnities, including specifically a currency indemnity, other indemnities, and then an indemnity to the agent bank. All of these charges are paid by the borrower, so what we can essentially do is we're going to extend those under 9.1, so that 9.1, A, B and C will then include all of these other charges that we've mentioned in 12, 13, 14, 15. The banks are under an obligation to mitigate costs and expenses where they can. That's provided for under 15. They have a reasonable obligation to mitigate. It specifies that they have to take all reasonable steps to mitigate and reduce the costs involved. And then other costs and expenses as well. So the borrower will also pay these other costs, including transaction expenses, amendment costs, and enforcement costs. So we can see that 9.1 is extended to include 13, 14, 15, subject to mitigation, and 16, as well as 17, and the fees under 12. So we can see all of the borrower's payment obligations under the facility. We then have a series of clauses on guarantee and indemnity. These reflect standard market practice so that the banks receive as much credit support as they can in practice. And we do that through each of the borrowers guaranteeing each other, as well as possibly taking separate outside third-party guarantees and indemnities. We then have the representations, which are effectively the representations and warranties. We've incorporated the covenants, and so we've incorporated the conditions precedent in 4.1 as conditions for utilisation. So 19 and 20 are the commercial and legal representations and warranties, and then the financial representations and warranties, and then the covenants we provide for under the financial covenants in 21 and general corporate covenants in 22. So we have these three key sets of obligations with the CPs, the reps and Ws, and the Cuvs, and we can see how these are incorporated into this standard document. The representations cover various standard provisions and clauses, status, binding obligations, no conflict, power and authority, validity and admissibility, governing law, deduction, no filing, no default, no misleading information, that's misrepresentation. So that's the core misrepresentation clause, 1910. And then we have financial statements, pari passu, 1912, which we also read with the sharing clause in 28, but do not confuse the two. And then no proceedings impending litigation, 13, very important clause. And then we also repeat these, so these become repeating clauses on each drawdown. We then have the financial representations and warranties. These are provided for in 20. We support that with the financial covenants in 21, which are usually essentially calculated having regard to certain financial ratios, which specify how the business has to be conducted. The banks can exercise a very substantial amount of control over the conduct of the borrower using financial ratios. This is a very effective tool in practice without the banks becoming what we call shadow directors, which means they're involved with the day-to-day running of the business, which means if there's any potential liability, they could be held liable. I've just summarised some of the key financial ratios there. Minimum net worth, earnings before tax, that's the EBITDA, dividend payment, cash retention, leverage ratio, and consolidated net debt. We then have the general covenants, general undertakings. The most important in practice are the negative pledge and the non-disposal clause. And then we support all of this with the default clauses in 23. Non-payment, financial covenants breach, other obligations breach, misrepresentation takes us back to the no misleading statement clause in 1910. Then creditor insolvency, insolvency proceedings, creditor processes, ownership of the obligors, that's the merger clause, goes back up to 22.5. We can begin to see how all of these start to cross-refer. And then any other unlawfulness, any other repudiation, and the very important material adverse change clause. In practice, a lot of time is spent on drafting the material adverse change. We want this to be general, but not too general, because anything could then become a default. At the same time, as we need to consider how that will operate with the cross default if there's a material adverse change as well. We have standard provisions on changes to lendors, changes to obligors, and then a number of important clauses determining the role and function, liability and exclusion of liability of both the arranging bank and the lead bank. This is all provided for in 26. The key clauses include the duties of the agent. The role of the arranger in 26.3 will specify that there is no essential duty of any form owed under the document. This is a no duty or basis clause, so that the arranger cannot be sued under the document for having done something which it didn't do, because it was under no obligation to do anything. Neither the arranging bank or the agent bank are fiduciaries under 26.4, and then we have a very wide indemnity clause in 26.10. We have the sharing clause, that's between the syndicate members. They have to share any receipts that is paid to them with other members through the agent bank, although there is an exception clause provided for in 28.5. We then have the payment mechanics in 2019, set off in 30. You retain set off in favour of the banks in 30, but you deny, exclude set off in favour of the borrower in 29.6 above. Then we have notice provisions, calculations, validity and no invalidity, remedies and waivers, amendments, counterparts, and then the very important governing law clause. We need to specify a governing law, which is the law that will determine the rights and obligations. This is most commonly New York or English law, and then also a jurisdiction, usually, again, most commonly New York or London. we can use other governing laws that are becoming of more importance, where, for example, an important financial centre is involved. It may be Europe, one of the main European financial centres, or it may be in the Middle East, it may be Shanghai, it may be Hong Kong. We may use local laws in some cases, although even then we may still go back to New York and London for the jurisdiction clause. In the schedules, we specify the parties and their relative commitments and proportionate obligations in one. We have the conditions precedent set out in two. We have request, that's the utilisation request, the standard form for that in three. There's a mandatory cost formula we mentioned before. That's in, it was in four. It's since been deleted simply because it's quite complicated now to make the separate payments. So that's now a matter of market practice. We also then have two transfer certificates. We have a novation and an assignment. Those are provided for under Schedules 5 and 6 in the revised documents. Then we have resignation, confirmation of compliance, list of existing securities so we don't breach the negative pledge, and then confidentiality undertaking, and then there'll be a timetable specified as well. And with all of this, we can understand how our typical euro loan document is governed and managed. What we also then need to consider are the transfer rights and entitlements. We've just mentioned there will be a transfer by novation provision made available under a standard clause in Schedule 5 and then an assignment provision in Schedule 6. The key point about transfers is this. Normally, banking and credit instruments historically were not transferable. They were personal debt obligations that could not be moved from one party to another. We changed that, amended that over time. We now have what we call assignment, which is transferring benefits under the obligation, benefits under the arrangement, benefits under the contract. Legal assignment was then consolidated under the Law of Property Act 1925, Section 136. And all of this is dealt with in the separate notes on transfer provided from the euro loan document. The Law of Property Act 1925 allows for legal assignment on three conditions. This has to be in writing, notice has to be given to the debtor, and the amount has to be unconditional. Under certain clauses, including, for example, the gross-up clause, it's not unconditional, so therefore we may not even be able to have a legal assignment, even if the banks wanted to give notice. In practice, they will not want to give notice, so therefore we will generally rely on equitable assignment. Equitable assignment has the same effect, it's just that we can lose priorities if another assignee, a second assignee, gives notice to the borrower before the first assignee. Because these tend to be closed deals in practice, using small numbers of counterparties and everybody is familiar with everybody else, legal assignment and equitable assignment are not that important. The distinction has limited effect in practice. The key point that arises with regards to assignment, however, is that you can only assign benefits. You cannot transfer obligations by way of an assignment. If we want to move the obligations under the documentation as well as the benefits, we have to have a novation. So what we're then going to do is we're going to have a cancellation of the original contract and we're going to have a replacement contract on identical terms, simply changing the parties. In practice, what happens is that in more modern documents, we actually include specific types of transfer instrument. We have a transfer loan certificate, so you can see there in the second paragraph, a TLC, or a transferable loan instrument, a TLI. A TLC is a novation, as provided for under Schedule 5 of the Loan Market Association Standard Multi-Currency Term and Revolving Loan Facility. A TLI is an assignment. That's now been included under Schedule 6 of the LME. If we want to transfer obligations and benefits, we will use a novation. We can also consider what we call a participation or sub-participation. That is where we bring in another party to provide the same obligations and receive the same rights, but without creating a direct relationship between the original obligor and the original creditor. We're bringing in a substitute third party. This may be known to the borrower, it may not be known. That's called a blind participation. In that case, what will happen is that, for example, the lead bank, the arranging bank, wants to transfer its obligations. It wants to be seen to be a participant member to bring together the other banks as part of the syndicate group. It looks good if the arranger is part of that. It only, however, wants to receive its arranging fee. Once it's received its arranging fee, it doesn't actually want to lend the funds. So it very often brings in a separate bank behind it to actually carry out the lending under the facility. This may be done on a disclosed or undisclosed, a blind basis. In that case, we'll have a participation or a sub-participation agreement. We can also have, with a blind participation, that's where we bring in somebody else that's not known to the original borrowers. With a participated loan, that's a specific type of blind facility that arises where, for example, the borrower or borrowers think they're dealing with one bank when in fact the funds have been made available by one or more of a number of separate banks behind the first bank. We call that a participated loan. We can also have a risk participation. It's the same as a participation or sub-participation, except there's a contingent element whereby the actual amount due is not confirmed up front, but will only be determined subsequently. This may arise, for example, in relation to a guarantee or a performance bond or a letter of credit or some other instrument where we don't know the liability until a subsequent event arises, until the amount due is confirmed. We can also consider transfers in terms of three other ideas, which are mentioned at the beginning of the paper: securitization, trusts, and an agency or brokerage relationship. In each of these cases, they're not actually transfers. What we're doing is creating a substitute, alternative, economic and legal relationship, which may have the same economic effect, but in law they're very distinct. So with securitization, we're going to transfer an asset from one type of facility, a credit banking loan facility, into a security, usually by using an intermediate, what we call a special purpose vehicle, an SPV. We sell a pool of assets to the SPV, and the SPV pays for them by issuing new notes or commercial paper into the market. With a trust, we set up a trust relationship whereby we have a trustee holding the asset. We have a beneficiary who has an entitlement to benefit from the facility made available. But there's two completely separate relationships created. We can also do similar types of adjustments using agency or brokerage relationships. All of this is mentioned in the paper. All of this is covered in the document. And we can use this to understand how we can create transferability within the standard loan market and the basic international euro loan market, and core documentation we can understand from this summary provided here.